Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Matt Dickinson, and for this edition of Lifetimes, I spoke to one of England's most renowned batsmen, Jonathan Trott. Now coaching at Kent, we sat down at the team base to talk about the glories of the game, winning the Ashes, becoming ICC Cricketer of the Year. But he also spoke very candidly about the struggles and the pressures of cricket and professional sport, and the toll they took on his mental health.
Five fielders saving the single on the offside with the slip. Three of them on the leg side saving the single. Trott finds the space he wants. The celebration will begin.
Get! Yeah! And that's it, Michael Hussey, last wicket to go. Mr. Cricket, caught a short leg. Look at these scenes. England, 2009, regain the Ashes.
ICC Cricketer of the Year in 2011, as part of the England team that reached number one in the Test rankings. Winner of three Ashes series. Yeah. You enjoyed, huge success, but also, I guess, have been very candid about the pressures and strains of the game too. And all of that glory, all of that struggle is vividly captured in a new film, The Edge, which is out this week. I actually had the pleasure of watching that film last night. It's quite a... quite an emotional journey.
I think it gets the right balance between, you know, the highs and also just describes, you know, how the team sort of that sort of time came towards the end of its career and sort of was time for change and how it all sort of came tumbling down a little bit, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly, yeah, so it's a film, feels like a film of real extremes, and I guess, you know, looking back on your career, it touched all of those extremes.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I certainly enjoyed a lot of highs and I was very fortunate to be part of a very, very good side, you know, and I count myself very lucky for the career that I had and the people that I played with and met along the way.
It seems in the film, one part of it, they ask you to jump fully padded up into a swimming pool or something.
Is that... Yeah, well, Barney, who did the film, he was the sort of... at that time, the social media and the sort of video guy that did all the stuff for the ECB, 2010, 2009, when social media, the internet and online access into the side was starting to, you know, grow hugely. He used to do that for the ECB and then branched off and did his own thing now. And he spent a couple of years going through unseen footage, and that's what makes the film so good. You don't get the normal cricket shot behind the bowler's arm, behind the umpire. You get sort of... unused footage that all the broadcasters haven't used or nobody's really seen. So you get to see different angles of things and sort of guys' emotions before press conferences, after press conferences of different angles. So all that sort of stuff, which makes it unique and very, very good. So when Barney asked me to jump on a train for 2 hours to Peterborough to jump in a water tank, you know, I was very, very keen to do it because I know he wanted to make something that he was very proud of and the guys would be. And that's why I didn't hesitate to help him whenever he asked me to do something, like walk in the Sussex Downs in my cricket kit. And that's another shot in the film. He had this vision for it, and he would get it right, and he certainly did.
Go back to, I mean, the film neatly frames, you know, your test career, really, isn't it? Because it starts with, you know, there's this sort of the climb of the England team and you coming in and famously joining that elite group who've scored a century on your test debut. Take us back to that and where you were in your career, that feeling of making, you know, your England debut and doing it in such a spectacular manner.
No one actually remembers, and probably quite rightly, in 2007 I actually made my England debut in the T20s for England, and sort of realised then, I got selected, but I realised if I wanted to crack at international level, I had to improve a hell of a lot. So it took me almost 2 years to get back, and Ashley Giles took over at Warwickshire at the end of 2007, I made my debut. And so we set out for the next 18 months to getting up to that time in August in 2009, when I made my debut, working on my game and rejigging it. So it took a while. It wasn't if it just happened overnight. There was 2 winters of Lions cricket, which is the England A side, and going to India and New Zealand and those tours. And so earning the right at playing for Warwickshire and on those trips with the Lions, getting my call up to the test match at the Oval. I was part of the squad at Headingley, which is a test match before, but they decided to go with extra bowler, because I think Andrew Flintoff missed that test match. And that was it, really. I was, you know, very confident. I walked out to bat, and you know, I've said it a few times, and it was the most fun I'd ever had on a cricket field. My first innings in the first test match was the most fun I'd ever had. I mean, I think walking out and Ian Bell was batting at the other end, so there was that familiarity, and having a Warwickshire teammate, and just felt really comfortable and loved it, really.
And did you feel, I mean, you go on over the next couple of years, and it's interesting to hear at times talk of almost an invincibility. Is that, you know, when you're in the middle and, yeah, describe it to those of us who've never had that privilege of being, you know, in elite sport and in feeling almost as if you can, it feels like you can do anything.
When you have that with a teammate or a partnership, I always love to focus on the partnership with your teammate. Not really, I try to take the pressure off my own score and just worry about the team score and try to add to that and be there for as long as possible as that grew, that score. So that's what I focused on. And when you can do that for a certain amount of time, you sometimes catch yourself thinking, you know, that you're in the best place in the world. You're in the middle of a packed house somewhere in England or somewhere in the world. And you helping your team hopefully get a lead in a test match or get ahead of the opposition. And that's why you train all those hours and you go to the gym. And when nobody else is training, you're training because you're trying to do a little bit more or be a little bit better than others. And I think that's a type of attitude that side had that's encapsulated in this film. You know, very, very self-sufficient players, I'd like to say, a very focused and determined bunch of guys that came together and all bought into the same thing and had one goal to be the best in the world, and we certainly did do that.
I guess some of your teammates, you know, even in a team that clearly was full of driven people, a couple of your teammates talk about you in a way that you were, you know, as driven as any, maybe more than most. Mm. For example, I think it's Stuart Broad talks about you measuring your socks when they came out of the washing machine just to check they're still the same length. Yeah. True or false?
Hugely false. I think Stuart likes to add a bit of text to things. It's actually to do with just getting the pairs right. Because when you do socks, when you tour for so long, sometimes they can fade. So sometimes the socks get messed. So you'll have a sock that's sort of 15 months old or 18 months old, and you'll have one that's 6 months old, and they're a little bit different. So if you send in five pairs of socks, they're all not going to come back. The people that are folding and putting your socks together as pairs isn't going to know exactly which socks are which. So I like to get the socks that are sort of the same pair, roughly the same color as well. It's more to do with the color, because they fade. When you go to the subcontinent, you don't know where your washing goes and where it gets washed. So, you know, sometimes they can come back a little bit different to how you sent them off.
There's a lot of perfectionism in elite sportsmen. It's easy to see why, I guess. It's the demand.
I think certainly, I think about this a lot. Certainly going into coaching now and the message I want to get across to guys and the way I want to be as a coach and my sort of philosophies is, when you play a sport like cricket, which is a repetition sport, you know, you repeat the action a lot. You know, when you go to tennis, golf, baseball, all those types of things, you know, the people that play the game will generally get to the top. They have to find a way, or some people would say a sort of superstition or something like that, that helps them prepare the same way over and over again. So you generally find that guys are very particular In the way they prepare, and that sometimes that goes into their equipment or the way that they're like what they want to eat the night before a game or wake up and a routine like that. So, you know, some guys aren't really like that at all, but I'm sure, you know, somewhere, you know, in their own personal life that they are like that, and to be able to get to be able to be so good at a repetition sport.
Jimmy Anderson says one of he accuses you of basically sort of polishing your the inside of your box to the point that it's sort of like a mirror and you're looking true or false.
Yeah, Jimmy's true that one. But I'd sort of you just sort of clean it and then I sort of just and sometimes you have a routine where you know you put your pad on and put your boots on. So I used to always put my left pad on first, like a lot of people do that, and then just thigh pad. And then box and just clean my box and sort of just, I think Jimmy's just elaborating a little bit.
But it can feel like it almost borders on a sort of a OCD thing. But as you say, that's another way of just saying attention to detail.
Well, yeah, I mean, everyone's got it. Some are more obvious than others. I mean, I remember Jimmy certainly, if I was a mid-off, before every spell, he'd want to bowl a few balls to mid-off just to loosen up. And I knew that he liked to bowl. I'm not going to say how many he liked to bowl, but I know there's a certain amount he likes to bowl. So when it was one short of the number he wants to bowl, I'd always just turn away and walk off. And I'd end up walking around the field after me to bowl that certain delivery. And so everyone's got their own little superstitions.
Yeah.
You know, Stuart Broad has his jump before a spell, and Matt Pryor's got a few things that he does. And, you know, everyone's got them. It's just some are more obvious than others.
You join an England team that is, you know, on the rise. It's, you know, it's had a nadir only sort of months before that, but it starts to sort of soar up under Flower, and there's quite a big deal made in the film of Austrian training camp, and it sort of makes it seem like a sort of SAS style, sort of brutal.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Austrian, some guys think they're in Germany. I don't even think they know where they were. I think they flew to Germany. I don't even know. I wasn't there. That's the funny thing, because, you know, my first child was being born. So we often joke with Andy Flyer about it, and that the two highest run scorers of that tour, which were Alistair Cook and myself, weren't actually on that trip because Alistair Cook's brother had a wedding. I think Cookie went for one day, but he wasn't there and didn't do as much as the other guys. So yeah, that's sometimes quite a bit of a point to have a giggle about.
Probably glad to have missed it.
Yeah, I think so. By the looks of it, certainly the footage I see in this film, you know, it's pretty obvious. The guys went through a bit, and there were certainly some things they confronted and some hardship. But those things are good, and that's very much Andy's philosophy and Andrew Strauss as well. You know, he likes to challenge himself. You know, in his own way, where Flower's a little bit more obvious for how he does it in his everyday life, and certainly at that time, and the way that he pushed himself.
And how did he sort of push you? How did he handle you, Flower? Because, I mean, again, it obviously we'll get into it, but the debate becomes about were people being pushed too hard?
I think Andy, you know, and I are pretty similar in that regard. We like to work hard and push ourselves and make the most of whatever talent we had. Our philosophies are quite similar on the game. We speak quite similar when chatting to each other about cricket, the basics and doing the disciplines and the basics really well. And focusing on a team, was the team is more important. Yes, I think cricket is very much an individual game within a team sport. And to find that balance is important. But at the same time, making sure that you've got your own house in order, I should say. Is just as important, so that you can add to that side. And he's very much that way inclined, and very focused on guys getting their house in order so that the team can win.
The high point, I guess, comes around the 2010 to 2011 Ashes.
Yeah, I think so. But I also think, you know, going to India and winning there is also, you know, it doesn't get touched on much in the video, but, you know, to go to then, it actually had been a lot longer than the Ashes win 2010-11, going to India and winning there. The last time an England team had won there was a couple of years longer than, you know, in Australia. So, and we think against that Indian side, we played against the greats, you know, Tendulkar, Sehwag, Harbhajan Singh played a few tests. So they had all the good players. Kohli was part of that, Dhoni. So yeah, you know, that was just as good. I just don't think, because it wasn't, you know, Sky weren't allowed to broadcast it. They had to sit in London commentating on the game because there were some TV rights disputes. I don't think it got the attention that, you know, obviously the Ashes captured because of the rivalry and the tradition of the Ashes. You know, captured everyone's imaginations. But yeah, don't make no mistake, that Indian tour was something special as well.
Well, also, I guess as well, that reinforces, you know, some people sometimes talk about how much rankings matter, but winning, as you say, the fact you beat India and Australia, there wasn't a sort of glitch of rankings. That was very much reinforcing you were
a
truly outstanding team.
Yeah, so to go to one, we beat India here 4-0. Yeah, no, we just played some very, very good cricket. South Africa came here in 2012, and they were very, I think they were at the same time that we were sort of 2010. They were very focused and determined to come here and get their number one ranking back, and they beat us here 2-0. And that's, you know, obviously, you know, everything started from there. And we obviously went to India. Kevin came back into the side and did really well. And Alistair took over his captaincy. And we had another couple of years of playing good cricket.
That retention of the Ashes in 2010, people would, I guess, obviously jump to the MCG and you scoring a century as the high point. But I'm sure before you told me actually that there was the run out of Cassidge that you sort of almost is more captures to you a moment where you just thought this game is I can do anything and this game's fantastic.
Well yeah, but I think it leads to the game before where Alistair and myself put on, I can't remember exactly how much it was, but we got to 517 for one at Brisbane 2 days or 3 days before that. And, you know, we were both pretty tired. And I know I was certainly tired. Alistair didn't seem to get tired that trip. And then first over of the game, we lose a toss and in the field, predominantly at Adelaide, which is a very batter-friendly place and you need early wickets. And I got the opportunity to run out Simon Cassidge in the first over, fifth ball, I should say. And then we got Ricky Ponting out the next ball. So that sort of adds to it, I think, getting Ponting out next ball and then an over or two later, we got Michael Clarke, and they were 5 for 3, and just started off, which I think is one of my favourite Test matches. I got 70 or 60 odd in our innings. Kevin got a fantastic double 100, Cook 100, and then we bowled them out on day 5 just before the rain came, which made it even sweeter. So wrapped up, I think, to bounce back the way that we did showed a bit of steel in our batting to come back at Brisbane because we were behind the game, and then we got an opportunity to get ahead of Australia that series through a miscommunication in their running, and I managed to capitalise on that.
I guess that Cassidge run-out, I'm sure when you've described it before, is that, again, that sense of almost you couldn't miss at that point. Which I guess there's the contrast in the film of almost just, yeah, can't do anything wrong, which obviously sets up the decline that's to come, that for a while everything felt easy.
Well, yeah, we're all playing very good cricket, and that's what happens when you're in a good place and you're feeling confident, and things tend to go your way as well. So everything sort of went our way that tour, except for Perth. I think we're playing good cricket, and when you have that feeling around the group and around the squad of confidence, you know, things like that tend to go your way. What actually happened was the couple of months before we had the Pakistan series with the whole match fixing thing, which I think brought us together as a squad and as a unit. Obviously it was the last Test match at Lord's which was had the actual match fixing, but then throughout the one days there was a lot of animosity between the two teams and that sort of stuff, and we actually brought us together, I think, as a side and as a squad, as an England cricket team squad, that actually I think put us on the right track for what lay ahead on a tough tour of Australia. So you know, we're a pretty tight-knit unit. We'll certainly remember that tour.
I'm intrigued to know how, watching back the film as you have done, that second half of it when you've hit the top and things start to go. How hard was that to watch back? It becomes very emotional, doesn't it?
I think so. But I think when you've been in it and you've had a lot of time to think about what happened and sort of a bit of closure on it, I suppose, on your international career. I think you look at it and you remember, yeah, there was some highs there and that was a bit of a tough time, but you sort of learned from it. And so going to coaching now, I feel it helped me be aware of, you know, what players and things that I've done in the past and what I use going forward, experience-wise, from what I've did as a player and, you know, help players in the future, and I think it only stands me in good stead for my coaching career and where I want to go and how good I want to be as a coach and where I want to coach. But yeah, it is hard. But I think you forget a lot of things. You know, when you watch that film, you sort of, oh, I remember that happening. Oh yeah, that happened. And but also the other thing is you start seeing your other teammates. You know, like they talk honestly about things. You know, so you realize, you know, you think back and you think, you know, jeepers, you think Finney was only 20, 21, and he was, you know, he had some tough times. And then Monty, and you didn't realize. And then Kevin, he talks about his things, and you know, and you know, you sometimes think, you know, maybe we should have. Not saying got together and spoke about it, but being a little bit open and more aware of each other instead of, you know, being just focused on being number one and being the best team in the world. You know, but sometimes you need that environment to push yourself along. And that's, you know, that's basically all I'd say on that. And that seeing your teammates and being honest like that sometimes is a comforting, but also you think as a teammate, you were one of their teammates, you think, crikey, yeah. Must have missed something almost a little bit.
Well, I think Kevin speaks very well about that in the film as well, just about the sort of feeling as if the signs were obvious and were missed. I mean, is, you know, that he was certainly, you know, starting to, you know, blow up basically with the mental
you know,
fatigue.
And I was speaking about it yesterday or a couple of days ago. And when I think about that 2013 season, you know, we were playing in Ashes. We played the Champions Trophy and then played the Ashes and then played a one-day series and then a couple of weeks off, then went to Australia. And we were sold the back-to-back Ashes, which is, you know, 10 tests against Australia. It's, you know, it's pretty demanding, especially going there. And don't forget, and I'll come on to it, but don't forget, when you go to Australia, you go a month before and you play three games. So it's not like you just rock up in Brisbane and you've had a month off. You know, you've been working pretty hard. We were there for a month. We had 3 days off and those are all three travel days. So we went three different cities we went to play cricket and train. But I remember I played the Champions Trophy and then played the Ashes, then played the ODIs. And the only three people from the Ashes to play the ODIs were myself, Kevin and Joe Root. Kevin didn't play in the Champions Trophy because of injury. So he had just played the Ashes. And so the only two people were myself and Joe Root. And I think Root had come international cricket a year earlier or something, I think against that India tour. So he had only really come in. He'd only been playing international cricket for almost 6 months. So that's the difference. I said, no, I want to play the ODIs. You know, I remember Andy Flower asking me at the Oval, do you want to play in the ODIs? I'm like, yeah, I want to play in the ODIs, but I didn't have as good Ashes as I wanted to. You know, but at that time, knowing that I was sort of struggling, but wanting to, you know, get myself out of whatever I was going through by just scoring runs, because that's generally always happens. You get a few runs, you feel better, don't you? So, and I thought that was the answer. But in hindsight, if I'd just taken a few weeks off like everyone else. And, you know, maybe it would have been a lot different. So I sometimes think back on that. So then I played the ODIs. I didn't do very well there. And then we had 2 weeks before we went to Australia. And those 2 weeks I spent 5 days a week and then indoors for a couple, 3 or 4 hours, you know, not really having a break in the nets where everyone else again was resting. You know, and I was foolishly working and pushing myself to the nth degree, basically. Got to Australia and was okay. I did really well. I remember averaging 100 in the warm-up games in Australia, but it wasn't really test cricket and under the pressure. Whereas in 2010-11 series, when those three warm-up games, I averaged something like 25, you know, but I was in a better place. So that's, you know, I live and learn from those sort of things. So when I say going forward in my coaching career, you know, there are times, you know, that I would have learned from fantastic coaches about pushing players and then when they need to be pushed. But also at the right time now, you know, where they're saying, actually, you know, I think you need to take your foot off a little bit. And actually sometimes being the right option is sometimes actually say, no, I actually need a little bit of a break from cricket. I need a refresh, which I think nowadays the players now are looked after very well but from the ECB because they're going to go from a World Cup pressure situation and they're playing in the final like we did in 2013. We got to the final. So our tournament was extended. If we hadn't played the semis in the final, we would have had a bit more time off. And they're going to be playing in the final. Then they've also got the Ireland Test match, and then they've got the Ashes. And then they go to New Zealand, then they go to South Africa, then they go to Sri Lanka, and that's all before March next year. So you can see the international workload is getting very busy. And I think the ECB are very, very switched on about that and getting guys rest.
Much more so, obviously, now than then. I mean, that you touched on before, that sort of inability to... for someone to maybe sort of speak out or, you know, see the sign in either in themselves or others and sort of bring it onto the table. Is that a sort of masculinity thing? Is that?
Well, I think it was a sign of the times then as well. I think it was a bit different to how it is now 6 years on. I think the world's very different about that. I mean, a great example of that. I remember before my debut, 2009, they wanted me to play. They said we were going to be playing the test match on Thursday. And this was Friday, I think. So Thursday. And they said, we want you to go play in the Lions game because Australia were playing a two-day game at Canterbury, funny enough, on the Saturday, Sunday, and then travel Monday, train Tuesday, Wednesday, start Thursday. And they wanted me to go and play just so I could practice against their bowlers, if you like. But I just had a four-day game against Nottinghamshire. And I remember speaking to Andy Flower, you know, he said, congratulations, you selected, you know, we want you to play the Lions game still, because I was down to play. And I remember saying, Andy, you know, I just had a tough 4 days against Nottingham here. We followed on, I batted, I got some runs in the second innings. I'm feeling really good. Is it at all possible that I can miss that Lions game and see you guys on Monday night, just have the weekend at home and just relax, clear my mind, ready for my debut test match? And I look back on that and I think, you know, I had such clarity in that decision-making to ask a guy who I respected hugely, even though I hadn't really played for him at the time, Andy Flower, that I had the courage to say, you know, listen, can I just not play this game? Mm. If I hadn't have got runs, or if I didn't feel in good form, obviously I would have played. Well, if I hadn't have got runs, or if I hadn't been in good form, I wouldn't have been playing in the test match probably. And, you know, he asked me, shut up, do you want to play in the ODIs? And I was very bullish and, you know, very, of course I want to play, sort of, you know, perhaps your ego going a little bit and wanting to prove yourself. I don't know who I was trying to prove myself to at the time, but that's where I lost the ability to see the wood from the trees, the sort of perspective that you need at international level, that clarity and decision making off the field as much as on it. That's basically the difference in that sort of decision making and that clarity you need.
So I think you've used, you know, you said that when the game becomes life and death to a player, that's, you know, obviously as fans, people want to think the players take it super seriously, but actually it can reach a point where it's all consuming, and that's
when it starts going away from the field and you start, you know, it starts affecting you, yourself, how you sort of think about yourself and yourself, image that you have of yourself, I should say. And the way that other people view you, you know, so sometimes, you know, you need to be able to switch off and not be the cricketer. But at times when you just want it so badly and you lose that perspective, you know, you want it so much that it's all consuming, really. And so that you can't get that break and have that time away, and you're living it 24 hours a day. So that's what I meant when I say it becomes life or death. It becomes all consuming, and it feels like there's nothing else really besides cricket. You don't have that perspective of, you know, life and being just a normal human like everyone else in this world.
You say that night and day because you talk about waking up at 3, 4, 5, 6 in the morning.
Well, yeah, I think everyone has those nights where you're worried about your place and you have those sleepless nights. So yeah, I think you have those times, but I just remember it very, very, very vividly, and I've actually got a very amazing sort of way of remembering lots of details and stuff like that about dismissals and how I was feeling at the time and how I felt in the net. Did I feel in good form? That sort of thing. So when it comes to describing how I felt, you know, I can recall things pretty well. So you're so desperate to do well, you're willing to try anything, and you lose the clarity that you need in training, as I say, on and off the field, which is what all good elite athletes have. You know, they have that time when they can say no, you know, actually I've trained enough, I can switch off. And I look back to all the times when I've scored runs or been in good form, I've actually had that clarity in the net of going, you know what, I can't do anymore, I'm hitting the ball so well. You know, and it happens in all sports where guys actually, you take a lot more confidence by being able to walk out of the nets or walk out of practice and being able to call time on a bit of training session. It's the times, and you can also remember the times when you feel like, oh, I'm not hitting the ball well enough, and you don't feel quite right when you leave training. So that's what it's important, and that's why I say going forward as a coach, you know, that clarity, so I can spot when guys are doing things that are improving their cricket, either batting, bowling or fielding, and when you can actually see that it's having a negative impact.
We mentioned the pool. I mean, that's framed around the point when Mitchell Johnson's steaming in, and as you say, you mentioned before, that sense of sinking, and a couple of players talk about, you know, you walking past in tears. I mean, it's a hugely powerful part of of your story that's powerfully told in the film. That, you know, what, how did you feel watching that?
No, I was fine really about it. I don't mind at all really. I've had a lot of time since my international career finished, and had a lot of time to think about it and process it. And what I'm proud of is coming back from that and earning my place back in the side. And 2015, going to the Caribbean with the boys, and at that time, the side is very different. There's a huge changeover. Swanee, Kevin, a whole lot of guys have retired, and I'd worked my socks off to get back in that side. I went on a Lions tour and did pretty well there, earned my place, and it wasn't as if it was given back to me when I said, yeah, I'm ready to play. And I had to go back and earn it. I had to score runs for Warwickshire, I had to score runs for the Lions, I had to score everybody and earn my spot. And I'm very proud of that, just as much as coming back from what were some tough times, but certainly learned from those. That's certainly, I look back on that with a lot of pride. It didn't go the way I wanted to in the Caribbean. Maybe there's more scarring than I thought. Obviously now, knowing, having been through the whole thing of coming back from Australia and earning my place back, you sometimes when you're batting there, you can see the media centre and the reflective glass. But once you've been through it, figuratively, I should say, you now know what's going on, what's happened, and get written about, and things get said, and all those sort of things. You're not as oblivious to it as you when you were sometimes once going to the side. So
it does feel like the story would be framed very differently now. It wasn't that long ago, and yet it feels like the world has moved pretty fast. That you coming home as you did, and the questioning Michael Vaughan and others, it feels like the world would be
a lot
more understanding.
The day I got home the evening, and then I went out the next morning, and I had the son had a camera over my wall and asking me questions, not ringing my front door, and that wasn't great. And then the Telegraph wanted, first interview type thing, and we decided to go with someone that, we're friends, friends in the media, or sort of I knew very well, a good relationship, I should say, not friends, but more relationship I've got on really well with. And then the Telegraph decided to, basically run a week or just over a week of every day some sort of negative stuff. So that was pretty hard to take, but certainly again, it toughens you up for what's needed to if you want to go back into that area and or that sort of arena, if you like, and play. But you become a little bit aware, you grow up, I suppose. It was really tough, and it was different. I think nowadays it's very different. So I did a TV thing, but I wanted to get it out there, and I wanted to be open about things. And when I left Australia, people said it was, I wasn't sure what was going on. I didn't know. I honestly didn't know. I don't know why I'm feeling like this, but I just felt sick, basically. And the ECB then, put me in touch, with a normal psychologist. And after 6 weeks, I remember the day, driving around in Birmingham, almost exactly 6 weeks, I was like, gee, I feel like playing cricket again. But because I hadn't been in that pressure situation, you feel okay, and it slowly you heal and you get better. And then I did this TV documentary with Ian Ward, and it was, I basically said, oh, that looks fine, exactly right, because the psychologist, the ECB, said, oh, it's just got a bit of burnout, 6 weeks, you've been playing nonstop for a few years, I see this all the time type thing. And then I remember I did it, and I went to Cape Town to see my brother, and I played in an old boys game, so it's basically playing against schoolboys. They're the first team at school, and I was, an international cricketer, I suppose, at the time. And I remember sitting on the bench that I normally always sit on when I used to play years before, 10 years or even more, 15 years before. And suddenly I saw the first ball bowled. I'll never forget it. And I was like, jeepers, I feel like I'm back in a test match. And trees basically turned into like the stands at Brisbane again. And I just realized, I knew there was something, there's something wrong here. So then I went back and I played for Warwickshire exactly the same after one game. I dropped a catch and this was terrible and was in no condition to play cricket. And then the next day, through the contact and relationship with the with a male who I did the interview with, got hold of, got Steve Peters, and you know, he called me back after leaving him a message, and I went to go see him that day, and within an hour of being with him, I knew I'd be fine. And you know, because he's a psychiatrist, a clinical psychiatrist, very different. He's done a lot of work with a lot of sports, some fantastic, you know, a lot bigger names than I am or ever be, but all very much the same, very similar, you know, characteristics. So he could basically tell me, and I enjoyed how he worked with it all and being very direct about, you know, if I said something to him, he'd just say, well, this is what you got to do. Whereas a lot of the times I like that. I like the black and white. I think sportsmen actually deal in black and white, failure, success, when you boil down to it. So you like the black and white of this is what you need to do, the direction that people send you in. Whereas the psychologist, if you said, I don't want to talk about that, he would go, okay, that's fine today. Whereas Steve would go, no, we need to talk about this. Let's do this.
Right.
So I quite liked that sort of approach, and so that I could get to the bottom of what was happening. So he basically just said, right, you've just, over the years, and you've pushed yourself so hard, you know, you've got a situational-based anxiety. You've lost perspective of cricket and the importance of it and how much of value you put on it. And that was it. And certainly at the time, I think, you know, because I'd left Australia and we had said we got a stress-related illness, which it was. And at that time, everyone wasn't as clued up, or it wasn't as spoken about now, how people felt away from the game personally. It was all about whether you, what form you're in, how you scored runs. Were you, you know, then everyone really worried about the person as much as they do now, maybe. And they said, you know, I certainly feel, so they said that, you know, stress-related illness, that's what the doctors, and we were sitting there as the day I was leaving, what were we going to say? The media liaison for the cricket side. And if I just said, I look back and I would just said, you know, if I got depression, basically, which I didn't have, I mean, I've never had. I'm very fortunate, you know, lucky enough to not, and feel for everyone else who has, that I would have been probably given the space that I'd maybe needed at the time. But because everyone had believed that I'd had something like that, and when I did the TV documentary, I just said, oh, I was burnt out, and, you know, then people didn't buy that. So I think nowadays the perception people have is, you know, a little bit more understanding of stuff and you know, what sportsmen go through, and, you know, that's how the chips fell, I suppose, for me then. But I think it's certainly a little bit different nowadays.
The word resilient is so important in this game, because you get knocked down a lot and you have to get up again and fight. In that time, you or your team will reveal themselves.
The game never changes. It's all in your head.
Playing for England is the ultimate. But while you're there, it becomes a bit like a drug.
A number of different stories are told through a match. Tales of dominance, vulnerability, the rivalries.
Living on that edge all the time.
It tells a lot about who you are. Six, seven. Making a movie.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a key point, I think, in the film where Andy Flower sort of, I think, asked the question, was it worth it? And I think there's almost a sort of key dynamic in the film about the drive and the intensity that the team and maybe your personal story to get to the heights you did. Was that possible without the sort of potential repercussions of then sort of falling off a cliff? Could you have got there without that drive?
It's very difficult. I think that when you want to go to the... I was thinking about this as well the other day. If you look at individual sports certainly as well, if somebody else is willing to work harder than you and sacrifice more, they're generally going to get ahead of you. If you're looking at cycling or one of those endurance sports, they're willing to train for 18 months at a certain thing and sacrifice diet, food. Whereas if you sort of, you're not quite committed, you're not going to train as hard, you're less likely you're going to do as well. So there's always someone out there who's willing to sacrifice more and train better and give more of themselves. Then you're not going to get to the top like we did. So that it's very difficult to get that balance when you've got such ambitious guys like we did and such individuals as we had, such characters. And when I say individuals, I say individuals in a good way, in that they knew what they wanted and they knew the direction and they knew how they were going to go about being the best cricketer they could be for England and how we were going to be the best team in the world. It's very unique, very unique time and very, very exciting, and one I look back on with huge fondness.
And that's, maybe is that part of being an elite sportsman? I remember, Chris Boardman, I remember talking about, he dropped his wife off to go into childbirth and went off to recce a course and was sort of like, well, give me a call, give me a call when the action's really started. And that was, he says he looks back and almost like, who was that monster that was doing that?
Yeah, and it is very different. You almost, there's so many things you sacrifice, and you understanding that your family along the way, and the things that you miss out on. You're certainly doing it, for them and to make everyone proud. And that's certainly why I played the game, was to make my family and my parents proud of me. So that was a huge driving force for me. Sometimes too much, so I'd say, in relating to how much pressure I put on myself and the drive that I had.
That was in that moment you felt that's what it was going to take, clearly.
Yeah, and that's what you do. And again, sometimes you get the balance wrong. You put a bit too much pressure on yourself, or you work a little bit too hard. And unchecked, that can be a little bit unhealthy, yeah. So you need people around you, to be able to sort of pull you back. Not pull you in line, but pull you back and say, hey, maybe take your foot off for a little bit now. Or maybe you need to put your foot down a little bit more. You need to be harder on yourself. And so getting that balance, and that's what makes great coaches.
And Flower sort of floats that question. I suppose he doesn't, he leaves it for all of us to watch and decide the answer. But yeah, if you were answering...
Yeah, he doesn't give you a definitive yes or no.
Yeah. So if you're, was it worth it? If you're answering it, how, does it...
Yeah, look, I look back on my career and whether, you know, with huge fondness. I wouldn't change anything for the world. So I wouldn't. I think it was all worth it. Yeah, certainly for me. And I very much. Yeah, were there things that I could have changed? Do I wish I'd played more test matches and ODIs for England? Absolutely. But, you know, you can't have everything. Nobody gets a fairy tale. I had my fairy tale in my first test match. We're not all like Alistair Cook, who does it in his first and last test match. But, you know, so I had my fairy tale. Not many cricketers get to have a fairy tale. And I was part of a fairy tale ride, a fairy tale team, really, if you like, with the characters that we had, the fun that we had, the laughs that we had, certainly.
We should say that there's a lot of pranking about on it as well.
You know, we had such good character. You think back to Swanee and, you know, and strategically putting my bag on the other side of the change room to Swanee just to have a bit of a break from the guy because he'll be onto you all the time, even if you do something slightly wrong. You know, was he's perfect, as we all know.
But it's interesting in the film, you know, you talk about, you know, the great career you had and how much you'd love to have played it more. There's the bit where you do get very emotional about what you miss from it, you know, just that bond that, you know, you're saying it's not necessarily scoring centuries you miss, it's just being with the guys.
Well, yeah, it's, again, and I said it earlier, just like when you stand at the non-strikers and you know, or for God Hervers batting at the other side, you know, it's very sometimes very different if to batting with Cook or Strauss or Bell at the other end to when Peterson's there, because all the focus goes onto him. You know, so you just let him go, and I enjoyed, and what I enjoyed actually most was how each batter was different. So as what I tried to do is then you speak differently during overs, you know, so you with Kevin it was more like just see the ball, hit it, you know, he's rubbish, whack him. Whereas with Cook it'll be a little bit more technical, a little bit more, you know, you and me, let's focus on a partnership type thing. And so I that sort of difference, and you know, the difference in personality of teammates and how they operated was actually what intrigued me and I enjoyed the most. So being able to adjust to each different teammate, obviously with Ian Bell I played with for a lot longer, Andrew Strauss, you know, he was my first captain, so always whenever I batted with him, always just looked up to him. And I think you always have that with your first captain who awards you your England test cap. You always have that sort of, you look up to them a little bit more and you hold them in a little bit more high regard than, you know, other captains maybe that you've played with. So yeah, it's one of those things, and you know, no special times and special people.
There were some pretty some fun insights into the sledging that we don't always get from on it as well. I mean, just going back, and obviously we've got an Ashes series to look forward to, and the edge that always brings. I mean, when you were out there in the middle, what was the scale of sledge like?
Not much. Not a huge deal, actually. I think now with all the stump mics and stuff, guys losing 20-30% of their match fees, the guys tend to keep a little bit quieter.
But there was this comment in there, wasn't it, about the broken arm and
I think what that was all boiled down to, and that, hey, the way that was is that the Australian side were very desperate to and very determined to get the Ashes back, and maybe boiled over a little bit, and they hadn't done it for a few times, and so they were, you know, they're very passionate about beating England, and they spilled over across the line, maybe just a little bit of stuff like that. And, you know, but don't get it wrong. We were no angels as well. You know, we certainly, when we were on top, we certainly enjoyed it, and we certainly let other people know as well. Yeah. So you have that stuff. And, you know, for me, playing against South Africa, there was always banter on the field, and I really enjoyed that because, you know, I've huge respect for South Africa and the country that allowed me to grow up, and you know, very very passionate for the way that I was allowed to develop and the schooling system that I had and the upbringing that I was afforded. You know, I felt very lucky and probably the best. I feel probably the best upbringing, you know, any schoolboy could have. So very thankful, but also, you know, very very determined to win games for England against South Africa. So having played against a lot of those guys, there was always banter flying around in comments. And so the one thing that frustrated them was that they couldn't say anything in Afrikaans because I'd be able to understand it.
So when you say banter, I mean, what, they're giving you a stick for being a turncoat?
I remember my second test match was actually in Centurion and Steve Davis was an umpire. I walked out to bat and he actually said he's the only Englishman on this field because I was batting with Kevin at the time. So, you know, he said
even the umpire's
but, he,
you
but he actually is Australian, but he was born in England. So he was saying he was the only Englishman on the field. So I was getting chirped by the umpire, never mind the South African players in my second test match in Pretoria. But I think the thing with sledging, there's always, I think it's slightly overplayed in that it's not really that much in your face sledging. You know, it's more intimidation through aggression and performance. The Australian side, and don't get me wrong, there are one or two guys that are slightly indifferent characters, but the Australians, they love cricket and they're very respectful for the game. And I've spoken to a few of those guys that I've played with in the series before and series after, or that series, and just said, you know, very respectful. And there's that mutual respect between the two countries. Yes, on the field, it's very passionate and very, there's a lot of aggression and both teams wanting to win, you know, just as much as the other. But there's that respect for the game, but also their respect for each other.
As we've seen from the World Cup, the Aussies is getting, or some of them obviously getting plenty, sandpaper gate, etc. There'll be no lack of that when it comes round. What are you expecting from this Ashes series?
Well, I expect the England side to, you know, continue where they left off with their victory in Birmingham in the semi-final. And I think it's going to be a lot tighter than, you know, people, I don't ever write off an Australian side when it comes to the Ashes. And there's always a lot of passion, and we've seen some great series in the past. Obviously, England will be wanting to get their hands back on the Ashes, and you know they've got the team to do it. So I think England will win, but it's going to be a great contest, and I think it'll be one of the greats.
And this England team, you know, you say you were part of a side that's got to number one and was very dominant for a couple of years. Where do you put this team in its evolution, I guess, in the test format?
Well, yeah, I think if you look at the rankings, it wouldn't be as high as you would have liked. I think there's been a lot of focus on one-day cricket, and then I think that when that's all done and said and done, there's going to be a huge focus on test cricket and getting that right. You know, the loss of Alistair Cook is a huge loss, and I think only now, you know, when he's gone, you realise the gap and the amount of cricket that he's played and the bedrock he's been opening the innings for England for so long, and irreplaceable, if you like. No one's irreplaceable, but he's the closest thing you'll get to that. And also, you know, with the guys who've been in the past, and what would you give for a Kevin Peterson right now, or an Ian Bell, or, you know, that sort of stuff, or Andrew Strauss. So they've got the talent, but it's about just the application. And because if you look at the way they play one-day cricket and the way that they've transformed their one-day success, there's no reason why they can't do it in test cricket as well and continue to do it in one-day cricket and T20.
Considering you get to number one in the world and the achievements you have, you know, yeah, it would be normal to have a reunion. But I mean, you watch that film and think, maybe that's not going to be happening. I mean, that's a pretty weird situation to be in, isn't it?
I don't think so. I mean, you speak to a lot of the you know, people who have played in teams or great teams, and not everyone got on. You don't have to get on to play cricket together. Everyone's going to have different personalities and different agendas whenever they're played, and they're going to see cricket through different lenses, obviously. But I think nowadays, the way it's so different is because of, you know, people used to retire, you never used to really hear from them again. I think because of social media, everyone's got a voice, so you keep having these, you keep hearing from people, and you just sometimes wish, you know, come on, you've had your turn.
I get the sense that you probably straddled all the camps better as much as anyone, is that right? I mean, if there was going to be a reunion, you'd almost be the man to get it, because you got on with KP, you got on with Strauss, you seem to be the man who sort of, are you the best bridge of the whole?
I don't know about that. I just think my job when I went into the team and I went into the England side, there's such, you know, big personalities and big, such huge determination from guys. I just wanted to get on with everyone. I just see that's your job as a teammate, is to be able, because one guy doesn't get on with another guy as best of friends, or they don't get on as well with some, like they do with someone else, doesn't mean you have to sort of take sides. I always just trying to be friends with everyone, but also treat everyone just the same. So whether you were Alistair Cook or Kevin Peterson or Andrew Strauss, Ian Bell, having played 100 test matches, I'd treat you just as the same as I'd treat them if it was your first one, you know. And obviously, I think when you go into a side, you know, you have to earn the respect of your teammates and earn the right to be in that dressing room. And I think that's the biggest thing you need to earn, your teammates' respect. And if you get that, then you can do anything, I think, because they have got your back. So I just enjoyed trying to get on with everyone. That was my job. And again, also, I think at times you need to be able to, within yourself, is also be able to adapt to different teammates. You know, some guy would like something, another teammate would like something different. Being adaptable is what's crucial as to be a good teammate.
And a good coach, I'm guessing. I mean, we're sitting here now, you're with the Kent team. Mm. Do you feel that you're adjusting to, or have adjusted to coaching, and that it feels natural? It feels. Do you feel about it the way you would about playing as a passion?
Certainly. For starts, my dad's been a career coach my whole life. Since I've grown up, my dad's been in his cricket whites, still in them. So I've had my dad and my mom obviously played sport to a very high level. You know, she played softball internationally, and my dad was a cricket and football player and a bit of hockey as well. Obviously, coaching, all that stuff. So I got to watch him coach and watch my mom coach softball all the time. So I was around sport growing up, and so the fact that I've also been coached by some outstanding coaches, you know, I always knew that I'd probably want to go into coaching one day. So being able to pick the best traits and see what they did really well and how they connected with players is something I always took a keen eye on watching and learning from. And that's basically what I wanted to do. And I have that burning desire now as a coach, like I did as a player. I retired at the end of last year, and I haven't missed playing cricket one bit. Honestly, I don't miss playing cricket. And I certainly think I've hit enough cricket balls that any human should ever hit in his life. And that's where my passion lies now. I'm deeply passionate in coaching, and wherever that may be at the moment, you know, I'm with Kent, and I'm very, very thankful for the opportunity they've given me, and the way that I've, you know, Matt Walker, Paul Darnton, and the likes, Alan Donald, obviously, is, you know, it's a bit surreal coaching cricket now with the schoolboy hero when I was a schoolboy growing up with Alan Donald, you know, and so that's a bit surreal. But the way Matt Walker's allowed me to come in and get on with the batters, and also how reciprocal, you know, they've been to talking to me about cricket and allowing me in their dressing room, it's been great. And, you know, having a pretty decent season in the four-day stuff.
That mental, I mean, that as well, that's, I guess that's what we've talked about as much in this as anything, that mental side. I mean, do you feel that you've got an ability to help people to get into the right mental place, mm. and to, you know, through your own experiences, maybe to intervene more than was done?
No, I think, but also, you know, when I was a player, I used to enjoy the power of concentration and what it meant to be able to concentrate, and things that I used to do away from the ground, and when you do a bit of focusing and that sort of stuff, or I used to do a bit of hypnotherapy and that when away from the game, just, you know, preparing myself for the cricket so that when I could get into that state of concentration and being relaxed. So everyone has their own different things, and it's being open-minded to some guys do things differently, and as a coach, being able to go with that and trying to add things to it, not try and change them all, you know, because sort of reinvent the wheel with the player, because sometimes as a player and sometimes in people in life, you know, all that they've got is their confidence in themselves and the package that they have as a cricketer, you know. So if you go in there and say, well, you're doing it completely wrong, you could destroy a person's confidence, because that's all he has. If you're going to a cricket match or you're going to work tomorrow, you know, all you've got really is the confidence in yourself and that you can deliver if you've got a presentation or you've got to go bat for hopefully 6-7 hours, whichever you can bat the whole day. So if you start telling them, well, you're doing it completely wrong, then, you know, you don't give them much chance. You're not giving them that much confidence.
Yeah.
But being able to say, you know, I think that's great what you're doing, but if you maybe how about trying this, I think this will enhance it and it'll make you even more powerful or make you an even better player or make their presentation slightly more slicker or whatever. I think that's what separates the average coach from the very good and elite coaches.
Are you going to sit down? Did you watch the film on your own, or are you going to sit down with the family and watch?
I watched it at home, and
with family. Or?
Yeah. Oh, they're very, very good. Yeah,
it's nice to feel good to have it as almost as a sort of nicely packaged up to tell the story. You know, to obviously you've done your book as well, but it's do you feel it's a sort of accurate? Yeah, representation of everything, the good and the highs.
I think so. I think because you are there, and there's so many other things that you can't put into the film, but you'd need 3-4 years to get it all in, you know. There's certain things I remember that, you know, aren't in it that are, you know, funny or serious or, you know, very, very poignant things in the thing that weren't captured on video, I suppose.
Your dancing was there.
Oh, yeah.
What have you got to say for that?
I think I'd had a Foster's or something, but yeah, man, that's sort of again. But I'll never forget that image of where I sat down, and I think I can't remember if it was before. I think it was before then. There'd been a few cigars, and I've never seen Andy Flower not be able to control the dressing room as much as he did there. But he stood up and tried to say, guys, yeah, we've just won the Ashes. It's one of, fantastic. And behind him was, I think it was David Sake and Ian Bell and Matt Pryor all smoking cigars. And the cigar smoke was filling up the room. And I was on the far side and I couldn't actually see Andy Flower. So everyone knew they were shouting things. And he literally stopped halfway and said, right, I'm not making much sense here, and you guys aren't even listening to me, so we'll talk about this another time. And so it's little moments like that in that Sydney dressing room, and it's great. I don't even know whoever captured those videos, but I wish they'd edited out my dancing, but that was good fun. Yeah, Kevin and I used to do this song at the end of every sort of test series, and so that's caught on caught on video, which is good fun.
The song, what's the song?
I can't reveal everything, but it's a song from South Africa, so it's just a bit of a play on that. I think also there's a few videos of us sitting in the middle of the Sydney pitch and just talking about what the test series means and that sort of stuff. But even the guys who didn't play, you forget the likes of Ajmal, it's Steve Davies. Tremnett obviously came in, Ajmal Shahzad, Owen Morgan was there, reserve, Monty Panesar. So all those guys were out there as well, and they had their say and got the moment to speak out there and what they felt. So even when I see them now, they didn't necessarily play, but they were on that tour, and we'll always have that sort of bond, if you like, about the tour and the memories of going around Australia for the months that we did and then on to the World Cup after that, which was a long, long trip in itself. But special times.
Do you remember what you said on the pitch?
That's what I said. I remember saying, actually, it's funny enough, it started on the left of me, so I was the last one to speak. So I think everyone was sort of ready to go and had enough of it. And I just said that the most special thing for me is that exact thing, and that we'll have that bond, whether it's 40 years from now, if I bump into Ajmal Shahzad, and just because he didn't play, we'll still have that. Remember that time in Sydney, remember that time in Hobart, remember that, all those memories together that nobody else will, have in those special times. So it's brilliant, yeah, that's fantastic.
That seems a pretty good way to finish, I think. Pretty sweet way. Thank you very much, Jonathan Trott, for your time.
Thank you very much.
This edition of Lifetimes has been presented by me, Matt Dickinson. It has been produced by Lucy Lavery. To listen to household names speak as you've never heard them before, subscribe to this podcast. Search for Lifetimes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app. And if you like it, please rate and review the series.
Lifetimes is a Times Newspapers production. To find more of our great journalism, go online at thetimes.co.uk.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.